Do you really think all this is an accident? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, John?
The island.
Look, you want to push the button? You do it yourself.
If it's not real, then what are you doing here, Jack? Why did you come back? Why do you find it so hard to believe?
Why do you find it so easy?
It's never been easy!
It's a leap of faith, Jack.
Two players, two sides. One is light, one is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back!
We're going to need to watch that again.
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost rewatch podcast. This week we'll be covering season 2, episode 18 of Lost. It's titled Dave. Don't be confused. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and Hurley had celery sticks and steals a graham cracker this week. So what's our Connect Four snack? Mine are slices of cheddar cheese dipped in mustard, because I'm weird, apparently.
Not weird, I just never heard of it. My name is Joanna Robinson, and if I'm playing Connect Four and I have a snack right by me, I will stick with the celery sticks, but I'm going to add a little peanut butter, and we've talked about peanut butter on this podcast before, but I don't know if at the time I confessed that, like, I have such love for smooth, skippy peanut butter. That is my jam. So there you go.
And I'm Neil Miller, and my favorite Connect Four, and I'm happy to confirm this is also Nico's favorite Connect Four snack, which is Triscuit crackers and cheddar cheese. I don't know what it is about wheat crackers, but those are my jam. Might be able to wheat.
Some good snacking on this episode that is about more serious things than snacking. But first, let me tell you a little bit about the show you've stumbled onto. This Lost Rewatch podcast is rewatching ABC series Lost. It lasted for 6 seasons. We're doing it episode by episode. We're up to season 2, episode 18. We split this podcast into 2 different sections. Section 1 is called The Calm, and that's where we will only be talking about developments on the island and off the island in flashbacks up through season 2, episode 18. No future stuff. So we still have, quote, Henry Gale, unquote, down in the hatch here in The Calm. In the second half of the podcast, The Storm, we're a little farther ahead. We've rewatched the entire series already and are bringing any sort of foreknowledge, future knowledge, to our discussion of this episode. Dave, this week, we also have an interview. It's a full week. If you want to check out when all these things happen in this podcast, look down at your podcast device, and we have notes with time codes. Those time codes are accurate. Calm, storm, interview, skip to what you want, don't skip anything. The important thing to note is in these difficult times, we will be remaining exactly the same through the end of Lost. But that doesn't mean that our bonus content is going to stay the same. No, we're all locked inside with you at patreon.com/stormofspoilers. We could go to support the show and subscribe at levels to get different bonus content while we're all locked inside. Joanna has actually started something absolutely delightful with a friend of the pod called Feels Like the First Time. Joanna, what did you watch this weekend?
Well, friend of the pod, Kristen Russo, who you may remember from when we talked about Star Wars last year, has not seen a shocking amount of very famous films. She has not seen them. A trilogy that we started on this week that she has not seen is Lord of the Rings. I talked her into the extended edition. So, like, wow. Hats off to Kristen. She's really committing. I told her that Eowyn is essentially cut out of the trilogy if she doesn't do extended edition. So that got her on board. So last week we recorded an episode where she told me what she thought happened in Lord of the Rings. She was wrong about a lot of stuff. And you can hear that if you subscribe to our Patreon at any level, like at the bare bottom bones level of our Patreon, you get access to this podcast that we do. And then over the weekend, we watched Fellowship of the Ring, which a bunch of people like followed along with us on Twitter. Yesterday we watched Two Towers. So we just have one more to go. And then Kristen will give her reaction to be like, oh, so that's what happened on Lord of the Rings. It's surprisingly entertaining, not because of anything I do, but because Kristen is just like really charming in her inaccurate guesses. So I would really encourage you to join the Patreon and get those bonus episodes along with all of our other bonus content. So you can go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers to join us there. Other ways to get in contact with us. Okay, so first of all, if you've heard of dipping cheese in mustard, which I never heard of, but if you've heard of that, will you please either tweet at us at Storm Podcast or email us host@stormpodcast.com and let me know, you know, if I'm the odd one for not having heard of it, or Dave's the odd one for doing it, or if it's like a regional thing.
Also, Neil would like to know what kind of mustard, because there's a wide variety of mustards.
It's true.
So if you send us in, give us the deets.
Yeah, we need some specific mustard information from you. So
love it.
At Storm Podcast or email us host@stormpodcast.com, or if you're in our Patreon Slack, you can just drop it in the episode discussion channel in our Patreon Slack. You can go to stormpodcast.com to find out like the latest of everything that's going on with us, including who our interviews are, et cetera, et cetera. This week we have Lost writers Adam Horowitz and Eddie Kitsitz. They're here. They wrote this episode. They rewatched this episode just to talk to me about it. And, you know, they had some like, oh, interesting, reflections on that. They are also the co-creators of Once Upon a Time, the, long-running TV series on ABC, and then also, the new Apple series, Amazing Stories, which was they worked with Steven Spielberg on. It's an anthology series, with like a little genre twist to it. There's some great stuff there. So we talked about all of that. In our interview this week. So stay tuned for that. We have no new reviews this week. Usually this is where I read reviews. We have zero, none. I know you're at home. I know you're not doing anything. So write us a review, please, on iTunes.
The excuses are running out.
So that means I'll keep it to emails this week, and I will fulfill the promise I made last week, which is to read Amber's email. Amber wrote an email called Love and Friendship on a Lost Forum, ... a story. So she writes, I was a Lost viewer from day one. My mom, who has since passed, and I watched it each and every week together for the entire run of the show. A couple episodes into season 5, I want to say after Jughead, we had a question, and I took to the internet to search for the answer. If you're new to the show, Jughead is the name of an episode, but I don't think it's a spoiler to say that. I came across Lostpedia and enjoyed relaying people's opinions in the main forum to my mom. Some theories were so thought-provoking, some so crazy. I wasn't huge on having to figure out every little mystery and prove every theory correct or incorrect. I was along for the ride with the characters. So I quickly tired of that section of Lostpedia, or LP we called it, and wandered to the off-topic section. Here is where I found my people. I delighted in posting in threads about Whedon shows, thread you posted in if you're enjoying a drink or two, complete with a no editing rule if you'd had two or more drinks, made for interesting reading, and a thread for posting what we called dinosaur heads. Yes, that is spelled incorrectly. This thread involved using Lost screen caps in a 3-panel format and a poster dialogue from Forum as captions. We lovingly referred to these as heads. You might have had to be there to get the humor, but anyway, I really got to know many of these members. We were from all over, Florida, Boston, Arizona, Italy, New Zealand. We still chatted about Lost, just not so seriously. And we chatted about life. There were lots of meetups. When I had a work conference in Philly, I met with another girl who lived there for a drink. When a member threw a Halloween party in D.C., several of us went and had a blast. I even traveled to Hawaii to hang out with a girl who lived there. We went on the Lost tour and on another day made our way to the Losty Beach and convinced the guard to let us run around. We got to see Sun's Garden and Sawyer's plane seat. Several members got together to watch the finale on the rooftop in New York City. I got my first tattoo with a forum member. All told, I probably met 20 plus forum members. While we have now gone on to lead our own lives in different ways these days, many of us do stay in touch, if only at least on social media. So, when a fellow forum member threw a Labor Day picnic / long weekend get together the fall after the show ended, I went. There I met another member that I had interacted with. We just hit it off. We began dating, though he lived in the southern U.S. and I lived in the northern U.S. After a year and a half of long-distance dating, seeing each other only every couple months, I moved to his state. We got married the following year. We met Labor Day weekend 2010, married Labor Day weekend 2013, and have been happily married since. We were not the first love story from the LP either. I can think of three or four other couples that met because of Lost. I'm well aware that it wasn't a conventional way of meeting, but at least we have, we can say we have something in common. And then she says she loves the ending of Lost. So that's Amber. I just really liked that story. So
that is delightful.
Yeah. I've heard a lot of, I really like these stories about people, meeting through fandoms. I think that it's a really charming thing. Because Amber's email was so long, I'm just going to give a truncated version of this one we got from Drew. Cause Drew wrote in to say that, he's a huge fan of Lost. His friend told him this podcast was happening, so he sort of hopped on late, but is joining us for the watch. And he didn't understand that we would be beeping spoilers in the comm. So he was listening to the podcast in the shower. This is after the, COVID-19 news had started to hit. And, when the bleep out happened, I thought the world was ending or the start of the purge was being announced. I jumped out of the shower all naked and vulnerable to look at what I thought was an emergency alert on my phone. Then the podcast just continued. I rewound it just to make sure it was part of the podcast. I was very relieved to find out it was just covering up a spoiler and not the end of the world being announced through an emergency alert. So that's from Drew. So sorry we gave you a
spoiler. Sorry, Drew. Yeah, that's never, you are the first person that's happened to, as far as I know. The world's not ending. We just didn't want to tell you something.
So thank you.
Also, if it does end, yeah, we're not going to announce it here.
Thank you for your emails. You can email us stormpodcast@gmail.com. I've got a couple more emails to read in the storm this week, but thank you guys so much. To corroborate Drew's experience, I mean, I get freaked out every time there's a siren sound in a song. Do you guys do that? If someone samples a siren sound in a song and I'm like, where are the cops? Oh my God. So
What is it?
Or especially if you're like walking outside, you're like, they're going to run me over.
I'm just like, nope, never hear it. I don't even hear real sirens most of the time.
You don't have that register of your hearing. It's possible.
Yeah. Maybe it's a sonic.
You've been a secret late night DJ for so long. It's just second nature. You don't hear air horns. You don't hear sirens. Don't hear people telling you to stop the party. Neil, what happened this week on the island?
Oh, I'm so excited to tell you. This episode, Dave, was directed by Jack Bender, which normally is a good thing. It was written by Edward Kitsis and Adam Horowitz. It aired on April 5th, 2006, and it takes place on day 62 on the island. In flashbacks, we learn more about Hurley's time in an institution, the accident that led to him checking in there, and his quote-unquote friendship with the ever-bathrobed Dave. On the island, after deciding that he can trust her, Hurley shows Libby his stash of food. They almost make out, but are interrupted by the news that the camp has found a new drop of Dharma supplies just as Hurley was throwing his out. Seeing everyone bicker over food triggers Hurley, and he begins to see an old friend in the woods, the aforementioned Dave. In the hatch, the interrogation of quote-unquote Henry Gale heats up. Saeed, Ana Lucia, and Jack try to get some answers while Locke recovers from his leg injury. The answers end up being pretty fuzzy, but one thing is clear. No wheelchair for John. Get the wheelchair out of here. Back on the beach, Charlie begins helping Mr. Echo with his yet-to-be-named infrastructure project. Elsewhere, Sawyer is throwing away perfectly good Dharma Oreos. And for other reasons, Hurley pummels him into his tarp house and later provides a good laugh for Kate. After Dave tries to convince Hurley that he's been dreaming this whole thing up, the plane crash, everything, Libby shows up to literally talk him off of a cliff's edge. They finally do make out, and the outlook for Hurley appears optimistic. The episode ends with the absolute most absurd WTF what the hell exposition dump of all time, as it's revealed that Libby too was a patient at the Santa Rosa Mental Health Institute. Fun fact about this episode, guys. Michael.
There's no previously on.
Wait.
Go ahead.
Also, Michael does not appear in this episode.
Oh, yes. You're right. I missed that.
Yeah. This week's calm question is who do you think is the one tying Henry Gale, quote unquote Henry Gale, up in these intricate BDSM configurations? Is it Saeed or Ana Lucia? At one point he's in one of those like where he's like tied so that if you move it like gets tighter. Did you notice that?
That's some Saeed shit right there.
You think it's Saeed and not Ana Lucia? Yeah. I think it could go either way.
I think it could go either way. What if there's a world where like one of them's tying it up and then the other one's like, no, like this. And then they kind of like have a bonding moment. Wait, maybe I want to change my Island of Kistery. but yeah, no, I think it could be both. Everybody, if you're into good rope work, and I know this because I had a English teacher who was very into knots, you will talk about how good your rope work is and show it off at every possible turn. Because that's a talent that, you know, when it comes out, it's super useful, but it's not like it comes out a lot. So,
Do you guys remember? So, Shibari, right, is the name of the Japanese art of knot tying, often sure. used in sexual situations. Do you remember when Ari Hammer, like, outed himself by mm-hmm. liking all those Shibari posts on Twitter?
Yeah.
.com. Mm-hmm. That was a great time to be alive in this world.
Those are simpler times.
I'm not kink shaming him. I think it's great. It was just like so clear that he didn't know that people were going to see that he had done this. So, or maybe he didn't. He didn't care. Shannon, yeah.
And he was like, it's time for everybody to talk about Ari Hammer tomorrow. Just set it off. There are worse things to do, you know, on Twitter if you want attention than like some sexy shots that you like. All right.
I still think of Saeed, so.
Okay. No, that's fair. I mean, he was a torturer.
Yeah, torturer.
I just don't actually think that Ana is that kinky, despite like Michelle Rodriguez's like dom energy.
Yeah, despite her whole vibe.
Yeah, I just don't like Ana. I don't know. She works for her mom. I don't know.
She's a cop.
She works with her mom, but then she ends up.
Up.
Hey.
Shame spiral.
The world's not ending. I just messed up. Let's talk about this week's episode, Dave, which has... Okay, I'm going to talk about it from this direction first, because I went to screenwriting school, and my name's Dave. So here we go. We're gonna attack it from this. The flashback and the island, the way they sort of interact structurally, I like this episode. There have been a few episodes where I'm like, I don't understand why we're going back and forth. This, I really like it. Just in terms of building the doubt of within Hurley's character of his own reality, not super great on the weight thing and not super great on the food stuff on the island, but in terms of just like structure, like building from like the Polaroid to nobody passes Dave the basketball on the thing to suddenly Dave's on the island after we already know he's fake. So that actually puts us deeper into like another weird spiral. I think it's pretty well structured, and I don't want to step on anything that Joanna says in our interview, but I could definitely see how if you're building this Hurley episode from the ground up and you're not paying super close attention to what you're saying about the actual issues at hand, you could sort of stumble into Dave and be like, yes, good, this works, because it does work in terms of doling out bits of information. It has a twist that stays in its own episode. It ends with a flashback in a flashback that, like Neil said, is a total WTF moment that throws like the conclusion you just had back into question. I don't think it's a horrible mystery episode of Lost. I do think it's a pretty bad content episode of Lost, and I should probably not speak on that yet because I have two other co-hosts. What's up, guys? What'd you guys think of Dave?
Well, okay, so you know, we talked about this in the interview, which I really hope that you guys will listen to. But Neil said, like, oh, this is directed by Jack Bender. Usually that's a good thing. And I actually got to say, like, I have so many issues with the food stuff in this episode for a lot of reasons that we can get into them. But, like, this scene where Jorge Garcia is in, as you know, when Hurley's in that therapy appointment and talking about like how he killed people because he's so fat, and you're like, oh my god, what the fuck is this plot? but his emotion there is so real and good. And that to me, you know, Jorge Garcia is a great performer, but that to me is a classic Jack Bender moment of just like he, whatever he said, he just got right into the core of something that Jorge Garcia was able to tap into to bring to that scene. So there's just an enormous amount of authenticity to that scene, despite the premise being frustratingly alienating to me. You know what I mean? So that I value. And I agree with you. Like, I like the Dave, like, in terms of like it being like a Sixth Sense, he was dead the whole time. Sorry, spoiler for the Sixth Sense reveal. The way they hide the Dave stuff is pretty good. I think, I like the perform, I like Evan Handler a lot. I think he really masters. Evan Handler plays Dave. You may know him best from Sex and the City. That's his probably his most famous role, but like he really brings this like creepy, menacing, impish thing to the whole, performance, which really works for me. Something that one of our listeners said in the Patreon Slack that I really agree with is that you could do this episode honestly without the food stuff. There is a lot that you could, like, you can do almost the whole thing without the food stuff. In terms of, like, Hurley's, anxiety about getting close to Libby, you know, his own anxiety around his mental health, all that sort of stuff you can do. But the food stuff is frustrating for a couple different reasons. Number one, my guess is, I didn't ask the guys about this, but my guess is that one of the reasons they felt like they had to do this episode, is because, like, a lot of the fandom was like, wouldn't a guy as big as Hurley, if he were on an island for that long, like, be skinny by now? And, you know, they've addressed it before in the show, you know, where people are like, Hurley, why aren't you losing weight? And Hurley says something about it. But it's the kind of thing that I think sprouts out of a different time in the way that we talked about people who look like Jorge Garcia, and, a less respectful time, I think, of the dignity of people. And so, you know, the need that they felt to address that, I think they did not have to address it. I think they could have just like, I don't know, Island of Mystery, who the fuck cares? You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, wait till you guys get to the armpit hair mystery of season 5, and then you'll really be wishing for this again.
And then there's a presumption that Libby is the character we really like, right? She's enormously like kind. She's good at doctoring, which is something that we like, you know, all that sort of stuff. But she makes a presumption in this episode of, like, of course he wants to lose weight. She's just gonna like, you know, keep at it, Tiger, and you'll get there. And that baseline presumption of like, of course that's what he would want to do, doesn't always jive with like Hurley's whole like, I just like chicken and like being chill, like whatevs. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there's not a lot of, like public push from people on the island to be better people.
Right.
Except around Hurley for some reason.
Exactly. And so it's just like, it comes from, again, I think a different culture where, you know, that was the assumption that someone who looks like Jorge Garcia, like, must always be wanting to lose weight. Whereas now I think we're not a great place as a society. But like, you know, there is pushback on that concept where you can be like, no, you can like look how you want to look and actually be physically healthy. And like the thing I've liked about Hurley in the past and will like again, this is, I should just say, the worst the show gets around this. I don't think it like comes back to this point, quite again. You know what I mean? And so something that I think has been enormously, and we talked to Jorge Garcia about this when he was on the podcast, like something I really like about Hurley is the way in which he's like on these adventures and like the way in which like, what's the Hurley episode that was, before, oh, The Numbers. Like, in The Numbers, someone's...
Yeah, his little Danielle adventure.
Right, and Charlie's like, look at you. Or someone's like, look at you, you can't do this. And he's like, hey, fuck you, I'm gonna do it. And he does it. You know what I mean? And he's incredibly competent. And there are times in which he's just like, off on adventures, trekking around the island with everyone else. And there's no, like, you can't do this. You know what I mean? So, like, this really does feel like an aberration rather than, like, you know, the rule. And the last thing I'll say is that, above all else, I do not believe that Hurley and Libby, two kind-hearted, smart people, on an island where they're stranded, would flagrantly waste food the way that they do. It is appalling what they do, in the service of, I guess, mental health. So anyway, that's my Dave rant. All right, done.
Neil, what do you think about Dave?
It's
me. What do you think about me?
Oh, wow. No, I think, you know, when I rewatched this, the last time, which was right before we started recording, about an hour before we started, I found myself focusing on Jorge Garcia's performance and really connecting with, like, I think there's something really great that he does, especially in the scene Joanna talked about, where he's expressing sort of, it's weird because it's so similar to, sometimes the way they treat Charlie, where it's like they sort of try to scratch at what's really the issue. But they never quite have enough, you're never going to have enough time in a show like Lost to dig all the way in to what I guess at this point are second tier characters. Like if we consider like the Jack, Locke, Kate, Sawyer, maybe. I don't know. Would we consider
in the loop? The characters
there's definitely a hierarchy.
Yeah.
And so Hurley, the problem with Hurley is that Hurley is amazing until they throw a food issue at him, until they throw a food episode, like something related to his weight, his eating disorder, which in his case is an overeating thing, which I think there's stuff in the scenes with Bruce Davison as Dr. Brooks where they really do sort of get at some of like the pain and the loneliness. And there's things that I felt myself connecting to. But I think the point of why this episode is very frustrating is that it's only in those like small moments. And it's only if you're focusing sort of on Jorge Garcia's performance, which is great. If you're, you know, once we get to the, how everybody else is treating Hurley, it's like, come on, 2006.
I also, Bruce Davison has, like, that's not how you therapy, by the way. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you don't confront someone with their delusion like that. That's not
the photograph
that you do.
The Polaroid thing is like it feels very much just like a TV trick. And I'm like, no therapist, whatever. That's wild.
By the way, your reality's broken. See you tomorrow.
That's a hard, and our time is up. That's a hard no. Also, Klonopin is not like, it's not a horse tranquilizer. That's not what that is. So anyway, but I hear what you're saying. Yeah. I think what you're saying, if I may, mm-hmm. is that there was a way to do this.
Sure. There is a way to deal with, you know, I like the line where he tells him about like, it's the way you punish yourself. It's like, I personally have gone through stuff like that where I feel like there are times where like, I will eat to like punish myself. So like, there's moments in there where I'm like, okay. And then you see Jorge Garcia's face and you're like, okay, this feels real to me. But then it's like everything else, everything that involves, Dave, the character, sorry, not Dave, the podcaster or the episode. It's, you know, I don't really know how to describe it. It just feels like sort of the shorthand for all the things Hurley's probably has been going through.
There's just like a couple of really like ugly moments that feel out of place, like because of that. Some stuff with Dave, during the final escape that Hurley picks up like a plate of pasta and just starts using his fingers.
Yeah.
For like absolutely no reason.
That felt like a little much.
The fact that his backstory is basically another way to put the numbers into his life felt cheap at the time. Like, especially on a mystery show like Lost, where I'm looking for the mystery, like, allow moments to have pathos to not be a mystery box, because we need to open that box to find the pathos. So I don't care that, you know, the four-person deck was, you know, big enough for eight and there were 23 people on it. Like, I don't care. It seems all, like, weird. I don't know. Like I was saying at the beginning, I could see how structurally this came together. It just doesn't all sing together like it should.
And I gotta say, like, if I'm doing this episode, I might not even have a B plot. If I'm going to try to tackle something like this with any degree of sensitivity, I might not like have, I won't want my full hour.
You might leave the Hatch stuff.
Yeah.
For a different episode. And that is interesting because, one of the various fun facts about this episode is that aside from the two-part finales, season finales, this is the third longest episode of the show. This is one of the extended episodes. So it's almost like, cool. I mean, that clearly was an issue where it was like, we don't have enough time. And yeah, I think you're right. I mean, they probably could have done it right. But also the Hatch stuff feels is like interesting too. So it's tough.
This kind of feels like an episode that they knew they either, or they thought they had to do for some reason, but they had to kind of drop it in somewhere where it made the most sense. And, you know, we had food falling out of the sky last week and the Henry Gale thing reveal, but they're not ready to, you know, tip their entire hand on that. So time for a little bit of filler Hurley episode. But yes, I agree that it should have been all Hurley all the time. Because not only is the Hatch stuff kind of distracting, but it breaks the reality the show's trying to convince you of for a little bit that it could all be in Hurley's mind, because mm-hmm. we're jumping to things that Hurley has no reason to care about, let alone know about at that exact moment.
And something I want to say, and not just because, like, Eddie and Adam are so nice to, like, come do this podcast and I'm gonna be like, let's just, I do want to say really quickly, those guys who are also, you know, wound up being producers on the show, et cetera, they wrote some of my favorite episodes of Lost. So, like, this is not, we talked about that last week where, like, you know, there are writers who write episodes that are not your favorites and then write your absolute favorites and stuff like that. So, these guys have written some incredible, incredible Lost episodes. The best Hurley episode. They wrote the best Hurley episode. You just haven't seen it yet. You know, so like, mm-hmm. and what's interesting about this episode, is that, like, I think in its 2006 way, it feels like it thinks it's on Hurley's side. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like when Hurley pops off on Sawyer and like starts yelling about all the like, you know, fat shamey nicknames that Sawyer has been using on him, the show's like, yes, like the show is.
We have also been keeping track of all the things we've been saying about Hurley.
We're like, yes, thank you for beating him up. This is bullshit. You know what I mean? And so, and, you know, and the compassion that both, Libby and his, therapist offer him, like, that is something the show is trying to offer him as well. Like, the show is rooting for Hurley. It just gets some stuff majorly wrong as is trying to do so. And I feel pretty sure that if, you know, the guys, if Eddie and Adam or Damon or whatever were to make this episode now, that would not be the case. You know what I mean? It's just like, we have to remember the ways in which, I'm not like making excuses for it, but like, you know, the culture's so different.
Yeah. Well, and I even think that the there's compelling evidence in the fact that they never really do this again, as you mentioned, where it's like, they don't come back to this with Hurley. They have, there are other Hurley adventures and they are great. And so this does sort of feel like an aberration, which I think is, makes it easier to like look at it with, you know, to kind of revisit it with an open mind, be like, all right, was this episode really that bad? And there is some stuff in here that, yeah, is pretty bad, but, you know, there's also some good stuff.
Before we start cornering and picking up the scraps, I wanted to bring up this thing that Neil researched. It was all a Hurley's dream theory and how we kind of wish there was less, Hatch. Damon Lindelof said in a 2006 interview with Jeff Jensen that you cannot read here in the calm. Quote, we wrote a script last year called Dave. It plays out, a version of this idea that this is all happening in Hurley's head. The original draft was a great cause of concern. ABC felt it was advancing an idea that offered an explanation for the entire show. So maybe there was less Hatch in the original idea of Dave. ABC was like, whoa, you're just going to tell them this is all in Hurley's head, and then we're watching the Hurley's head show for the rest of that season?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think what might, in I was trying to imagine earlier, like, what would ABC have really freaked out about? And I actually think that it's possible if they were doing more along the lines of what Joanna said, where it was like less B story, they sort of spread it out. I don't know if this is even remotely true, but you could see the studio being like, oh no, we don't want that theory out there. Especially because remembering back to, you know, when the show was airing, the what does it all mean question.
Right.
The, you know, what are we really watching here? Are we watching the, you know, like the Men in Black version of the Marble, large aliens Marble? You know, people wanted to know what the end was. And I think as we've discussed with a lot of the creators and with each other on this podcast, they didn't know, but like fans wanted to know. Those message boards really wanted to know. So that makes sense to me. And that's kind of a funny, just sort of production, Easter egg, which is it, that this episode at one point was so good at putting the ABC executives in Hurley's head that it freaked them out and they were like, nope, can't do that.
Can't do that on your Jungle of Mystery show.
Yeah, we can't. Well, how are we going to get, 35 seasons of this? If
not even going to get to the zombie season.
I have a few other things I want to say. Number one, I'm really disappointed in my guy, Sawyer. Not just because of the various nickname bullshit, but like, okay, I don't know. Sawyer like went running off in the jungle after like a boar that he thought was a reincarnation of like whatever. Mm-hmm. There's a tree frog incident that Hurley reminds him of. Kate seeing like a horse. Jack seeing his dad, and like Sawyer's just like making fun of Hurley for this, and I'm like, you're in a jungle of mystery. Like, what the fuck? Like,
yeah, man. Why is everybody got to pick on Hurley?
I really need everyone to like, every time someone comes to you with a weird thing they see, I need you to start like believing them, because there's enough evidence at this point that like weird shit is happening, right?
Mm-hmm. Only the people watching the show are like, something's weird about this island.
Something super weird. And then, I guess, Charlie has a new boyfriend, in Mr. Echo. Charlie is like, you know, whatever Mr. Echo's working on, Charlie is here for it.
Yeah. He's searching for a non-Claire based purpose.
Yeah. Yeah. Charlie needs to latch, and, he's latched to Mr. Echo.
It supports my theory that it's a stage. Drive Shaft reunion.
Oh,
on
island. Love it. Love it.
Or, I mean, I guess it's like a Drive Shaft cover set, with one member, but maybe they'd figure it out. I bet Locke could play something.
Yeah. It is weird, because that is one of the things that sort of feels like it should be in a different episode, where it's like, okay, we're going to show Charlie, teaming up with Mr. Echo. Mr. Echo's not going to say what he's building. And then they're going to have like a 3-second interaction with Hurley, and that's it.
Just a little story there that maybe we'll pick up later.
Sure.
We just need to keep checking in on handsome Mr. Echo and his like sweaty biceps, and I'm okay with it. So thank you.
Fair enough. I will say Neil. That the, on the Sawyer thing, the throwing away an Oreo like that, especially on an island of mystery where people are not, there's not a lot of food. Unforgivable. Just of all the things Sawyer has done so far, the Oreo.
I mean, crushed Oreos is basically a condiment. I don't understand.
You're not going to eat
throw
it
that away.
Like, he just chucks it into the sand. Who wants a sandy Oreo? Nobody.
But if you had some frozen yogurt,
you could.
Crushed Oreo on top of frozen yogurt, the best thing you can do. And then should we just mention really quickly that Henry, during his interrogation, like, admits that he's an other, but, you know, looks incredibly fearful as he talks about it, like a him. Not the guy with the beard, not the guy who took Walt, but like another.
Mr. Friendly is out as the leader.
Who he finds out, and we heard Mr. Friendly tell Ethan something similar, like, you don't want him to know, like, blah,
everybody's
blah,
talking
blah,
about a him.
This him, who's this guy?
Yeah, and then Saeed almost shoots him. But, you know, kind of par for the course for sad Saeed at this point. I bet we come back to that, too.
Oh, I don't know. Also, Locke's frustration that he's not in the loop, you know?
Oh, yeah, and that apparently Henry didn't punch the button last week. All things I think we could safely address in a future podcast when they'll be addressed fully. But, yes, That was the Hatch things that we wanted less of.
I mean, we can't talk more about it in this episode, but I can talk about this, which is that Michael Emerson, who plays not Henry Gale, is fantastic in everything he does. And every time you watch his performance, like watching him, either you don't know. Is he lying? Is he telling the truth? Like, it's so hard to know. He'll like convince you and then you find out 2 seconds later it was a lie and you're like, what? So A plus Michael.
That sounds like a good way to pivot to our Jungle of Mystery moment, Neil.
Yes, the Jungle of Mystery moment. There are a lot, if you go in and sort of pull, the lines, the things that Henry Gale, quote unquote Henry, can we just call him Henry at this point? Quote unquote Henry.
Sure.
Some of the things that he says, especially to John Locke, but this one really stuck with me, where he says, God doesn't know how long we've been here, John. He can't see this island any more than the rest of the world can. Which is like, what?
he's an other, but apparently has no information on this island except that God can't see it, which...
That is crazy. Yeah. So, that's my favorite Jungle of Mystery moment, is just this, and it, you know, it's in the context of everything else that they're talking about, doesn't seem like, you know, that it would be that big, but like, you know, you gotta be like, what are you saying here, Henry? What's going on here?
What are the consequences of that? Why can Saeed supposedly not kill you because you're a good person? Does that mean anything if God can't see you? Tell us, Henry Gale, sometime in the future. The Boone Carlyle Memorial Falling Down Award sadly goes to Hurley and his Dharma peanut butter this week, which is a nasty fall. And I'm going to say the peanut butter did its job to make sure Hurley was safe. So rest in peace, peanut butter.
Yeah, the peanut butter is really sad because, as Joanna mentioned, there's not a lot of food on this island other than melons, fish, and whatever's on that palette.
Mm-hmm. Claire would have been devastated.
Oh, man.
It would have been like such a traumatizing scene.
The peanut butter that he drops is one thing. That's like, okay, that's it was a silly way to pack for an adventure, but like, okay, the peanut butter.
Are there no granola bars left in his stash?
The stuff that he and Libby just like gleefully throw away. I'm like, fuck you guys.
And then Jin like runs past it. Like, there's more food over here, but don't worry about that food over there.
Don't worry. The grocery stores are still open. It's fine.
Jin is having the best time this episode.
Yeah.
Jin is having a great time this episode. Our Henry Gale Memorial, obviously a lie award, still comes from Henry, not Henry, who says, no, I'm done lying to Locke, which seems like that's not true.
Lie in progress. Like, he's like, yes. No, I'm done lying. That it's in itself is like, it's like a Ouroboros snake eating its tail of lies. Yeah.
That was the last one. No, that was the last lie.
I promise I'm done lying.
Henry Gale loves lying as much as Claire likes peanut butter, you know?
Yep, exactly.
Joanne, I'm going to let you go over last week's Jungle of Kistery moment results.
Yeah, so a reminder that you can vote on who you want to see smooching on this island over on our Twitter polls at Storm Podcast every week. This week, the runaway winner, well, not that much of a runaway, but like pretty close.
Three of them ran away from one of them.
Yeah, okay. Nobody wants to see the thruffle of Hurley, Libby, and Kate.
Which makes me very sad, personally.
Because Neil really thought he could double down on his thruffle and get there.
Apparently it's not the thruffle, it's the members of the thruffle. Who knew?
Right, sure. Okay. Jack Sawyer, because Hurley and Libby seem like one man guys kind of people.
Sure.
So like,
and
know.
Kate already has Jack and Sawyer. So
Kate has plenty to deal with. Speaking of which, Jack Sawyer and a ruler, which is a mango poker joke, got 27% of the vote. Locke and the map got 29% of the vote. But number one is Locke and fake Henry. Remember when Locke's like, you didn't leave me? And Henry's like, of course I didn't, John. 34%.
This week they broke up though. Cause Henry's like, none of that was true.
It's true. Locke and Henry are not even candidates this week. So, I'm going to start with, our listener, suggestion. This came from our Patreon Slack. This came from Lauren, who's the one who like kind of kicked off this segment to begin with. Lauren says Libby and Hurley. I mean, it's the obvious one, but like, we want to see them kiss more. We love that kiss. It's a good kiss. Great kiss. And want more kisses for Libby and Hurley. So Libby and Hurley, that's from Lauren.
Yeah, like fun Neil. Kisses. That was a dramatic kiss.
Yeah.
Fun
Let's
kiss.
Let's see some casual fun kisses. Fun island kisses. Neil, who you got?
Well, in mine, it involves Sawyer and Hurley, but they have to be wrapped up in the tarps. Like, eventually they just get tired of fighting each other and they're like, oh, we love each other. And then they kiss.
Keith. All right. I'm voting for Dave, played by Evan Handler, and Charlotte from Sex and the City. Cause that's, I have so much trouble seeing Evan Handler not think of his character, Harry from Sex and the City. So Harry plus Charlotte forever on Sex and the City. Dave?
I'm going to take Dave, the character on the show, and Dr. Brooks, the guy from X-Men. So what would happen is Dave would slip into Dr. Brooks' office and be like, did you switch to Polaroid, man? And Brooks would be like, fuck yeah, I did. And then it'd just make out.
It'd be a slightly better cliffhanger than the one this episode leaves us with.
When you see, so you were saying that you know Bruce Davison best from X-Men, where his face melts off.
Yeah, all of him melts. His DNA decomposes.
He just clay faces off his own body. But I know him best from Harry. He was the dad on this early 90s sitcom, Harry and the Hendersons. And he was like so sarcastic on that show. Like one of those sarcastic, exasperated sitcom dads. Because he's like, there's a Bigfoot living with my family now.
My kids won't let me kill this Bigfoot.
It's the premise of Harry and the Hendersons. So whenever I see him, like, I just expect him to be like kind of shitty and sarcastic. So he's like, he might be a bad doctor. No, he is a bad doctor, but he's like, seems like a nice bad doctor at least. So, you know.
Yeah. Give him some kiss.
Seems like
me.
A well-intentioned
Storm podcast on Twitter.
Bad doctor.
So those candidates will be up on the, Twitter poll, this week. Thanks so much.
And finally, our official Lost podcast check-in. There was, of course, an official Lost podcast going while these episodes were airing that had the executive producers on it and interviews. You can still find them online if they're interesting to you. Unfortunately, this week, as I mentioned last week, in real time, 2006, when this was airing, but they had to be finishing up the second season and record these podcasts. So they're very tired. So this week's quote is Carlton Cuse says, let me just say it's kind of a joke. The zombie stuff is kind of a joke because they continually make a reference to the seventh season of Lost, which doesn't exist, being the zombie season. And then so Carlton Cuse says, let me say it's just a joke, really. The zombie stuff, it's kind of a joke. There was a pause, and then David Lindelof says, is it? And Carlton Cuse says, is it? Or maybe it isn't. And David Lindelof says, we'll see. And Carlton Cuse says, maybe it's a coincidence. And David Lindelof says, it really depends on how you define the word zombie. And Carlton Cuse says, or joke. And David Lindelof says, exactly. And then they pivot off the topic. I don't think the official podcast needs to be re-listened to yet. I will let you know when it is good again.
That being said, if you're in our Slack Patreon, one of our listeners is like making the episodes easy to find. So that's a feature of our Patreon Slack. I want to thank Steven for doing that. So he's curating them. So if you want to have the full experience, you can pop into our Patreon and get those audio files.
Fantastic. All right. While we're still in the calm, Joanna, why don't you tell us who we're about to talk to?
Okay, folks, so as we mentioned at the top of the episode, we've got an interview this week with Eddie Kitsis and Adam Horowitz, who are not only writers on every season of Lost. Yes, they came on from season one all the way through to the end, but they wound up being executive producers. They went on to run their own very successful show on ABC called Once Upon a Time. You might have heard of it. And they currently have a new series, Amazing Stories, on Apple, which we talked about as well. So here's what we're going to do for the interview. We have about 20 minutes of conversation with them that is spoiler-free. It's great stuff. We talk about the state of television. We talk about this episode in particular, all of that. That will be here in the calm. And then we will have a break, you know, as we usually do. And then we will go into the storm, which, you know, is our spoiler section. And we've got 10 more minutes of conversation with them that is very spoilery, including some information about that Libby cliffhanger that I don't believe has ever like been out there. I've never seen it somewhere else, and I've looked for it. So I think we got, I think we might actually have, you know, some information here, from Adam and Eddie, lovely, lovely gentlemen. Thank them so much for joining us, to talk about Dave, Once Upon a Time, and Amazing Stories and Lost in general. Enjoy. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for chatting with me.
Absolutely. Of course. This is the first time I had seen Dave since it aired, so.
Yeah, we haven't watched that in many years.
How'd your rewatch go?
For me, it was a weird experience because so much of it I had forgot, you know, because 14 years later, your memory really just becomes of the experience of writing it or filming it or editing it in little bits. But it kind of really took me back to that time. But then there was just stuff that I completely just forgot about, like the second palette coming, some of the Serrano stuff. I was just like, oh, right.
It's been fun to do this rewatch because, the people who are watching for the first time, they get really excited whenever it's a Hurley episode because everyone loves a Hurley episode, you know. Do you guys remember if there were any character-driven episodes that you got especially excited to tackle? You're like, oh my God, we get to do a Hurley episode or something similar.
Well, I feel like we lobbied very hard for Hurley, right away. So we immediately season one started like, you know, pitching Hurley stuff or tackling Hurley stuff. So we were always excited about that. But I, you know, the interesting thing about Lost was that it was such a uniquely communal experience that you really outlined the show in the room so that almost every episode you felt an ownership of. But like for us to go off and write a Hurley, was really excited. And then sometimes if you got like a character you'd never written before, like our first Saeed, you were like, oh, awesome. So, you know, it was exciting, but Hurley was absolutely a fave of ours.
Was there ever a character that you didn't get to write for that you wish you had been able to write for in terms of like a character focused episode?
Yeah. Over the 6 years, I can't think of any character we didn't write, even if it was
and
even a scene.
And even if we didn't, right. Like, even if we didn't write a character-centric for one, and I think we wrote a character-centric for almost every one of the mains, we wound up writing enough of stuff for those characters and other ones, it felt like we did. So it's like, and as Eddie said, it was a very communal experience writing the show and creating the show in the room, like really, the way Damon and Carlton led that room, like we were all sort of pitching in on everything, and it's like it all melded into kind of one giant episode at a point, which is why it was funny rewatching it earlier. It all flooded back in a weird way because it was like the separation of the particular episode out of the whole of the experience of making the show was unusual for me because I think of Lost as the whole of it, the experience of making the 6 years of the show as opposed to the individual episodes having their own life, if that makes any sense.
It's been interesting to do this week by week watch, especially since so many people don't watch shows that way almost at all anymore.
No.
I was curious, you know, your new show, Amazing Stories, you know, is unfolding week by week. What do you think is sort of the advantage of doing a week by week rollout versus a binge watch?
Well, I think the main advantage of a week by week is it gives everyone one episode to talk about. So when a show drops all at once, like Stranger Things, you'll have people who binged all 8 hours in the first 8 hours and people who are on episode yeah. 3 2 weeks later. So it's hard to like go on the internet and be like, what do you think of this? Because you may get spoiled. So at least when it would air or Amazing Stories once a week, you can just focus on that in and of itself.
I'm curious, you talk about, I love hearing about this communal sort of approach to storytelling that Lost had. Since you were there basically almost from the beginning through the end, how did that evolve over time on Lost? Like, did the writer's room change dramatically over time?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, Carlton and Damon kind of, that was kind of the system, and going in, I feel like that was always how it was. When we got in on season one, you know, true to network form, we were already behind. And they added like, oh, we're going to be doing 200 episodes this season. I really think we did like 25 that first season or something crazy.
It was like
10 seasons of a BBC show and the right. first seasons, literally. And so when we got there, it was very much like all hands on deck already, just because of the complexity of the show, and the amount of work that needed to be done. But that is also the philosophy they always kind of have. And I, as a writer, you love it because, you know, Adam and I are already partners, so we're already very collaborative. So when it becomes, it makes everyone feel like every episode is theirs as opposed to this one's mine and I'm leaving the room for 2 weeks.
And I think Damon Carlton also ran the show in an incredibly efficient way where, between seasons we would meet and have a few weeks of discussions where we would kind of outline the plans for how we would attack the next season. So like there would always be a game plan and always be a strategy. And it was always sort of, it was really challenging and hard, but it was always smooth, if that makes sense. Like it was the most challenging and difficult experience of our career at that time. But they made it a smooth experience, and there was always a steady hand, you know, running the ship. So that was what made it, you know, possible to do what we did on that show, because there was too much ambition to do it any other way, I think.
One of the things that I've seen you guys say a couple times about Amazing Stories is that the main philosophy you were adhering to is this idea of the ordinary meeting the extraordinary. And that, you know, and that strikes me as a description that would really appeal to people who love Lost, in terms of the reason Lost is so successful is you have these characters that we can really relate to and love and care for in the midst of all this mystery. That's something that you had on Once as well. And I'm just curious what you learned about calibrating genre and character on Lost that you took to Once and that you are taking to Amazing Stories now.
Well, I think one of the things about Lost that was always great is it was first and foremost, you know, a character show. And we always would say is the flashbacks were like little New Yorker short stories. And so the beginning, middle, and end aspect of a lot of the flashbacks, even though they would sometimes be like, okay, this will set up one thing, but then we'll come back to it later. Really, I think we took to both Once, which, you know, had flashbacks, and for Amazing Stories, which were, we had to tell five kind of complete stories. So one of the things, you know, those flashbacks really tell you is you have to define the character right away, you know, give a character mystery that then explains emotionally why they're doing everything. And I think we've taken that, what we learned on Lost, to everything we've done, including even, you know, Tron Legacy that we wrote, which, like Lost, also had daddy issues. So, you know, we take it all.
we love a daddy issue.
Yeah.
On a personal note, I was really happy to see that the second episode of Amazing Stories was set here in Oakland, where I live. And you used a local author, Shanaka Hodge, who's like a Bay Area legend, really, really talented young woman, to write the episode. So I was wondering how you found Shanaka and how that all came together.
We loved Shanaka. We were sent her script that she had developed at Sundance Lab, and we just fell in love with her writing, and we said, hey, would you like to come on staff, and any way you would be interested in redeveloping this feature script for an Amazing Stories? And that's what happened, and it was one of the most fun experiences we had. But what I love most about it is it's really like you hear Chinaka's writing, like she really, that when she brings Oakland to life and what she does, there's a really, like, it's just beautiful writing to me. We're huge fans of hers. And we just think that's one of the best hours of TV we've worked on.
I'm happy to see Oakland so accurately reflected. It doesn't always get that treatment, so I'm so happy to see it. You know, like when you see your hometown and you're like, there it is. They did it. They got it. Oh my God.
Well, yeah. You know, I mean, it's like I'm from Minnesota, so the very first time I see something that says it takes place in Minnesota and I see a mountain, I'm like, you've taken me out.
That's not it. not it.
I didn't see a mountain until I was 16. Are you kidding?
I remember really loving this episode when I first watched it back in 2006, and there are parts that I still really enjoy. But it's true that some of the attitudes sort of around Hurley and around even like therapy have changed so much. You know, looking back at this episode, is there anything that you would do differently when it comes to Dave?
Well, I mean, look, this was written 15 years ago.
So right, exactly.
There are a whole bunch of things I think today we would modernize. That was therapy as some of us maybe were experiencing it at the time, or some of the things Sawyer said because he was so provocative, we would absolutely not have him say today. You know, I think that's absolutely true, Adam.
Yeah, and I think after maybe us having been in therapy for 15 years,
yes.
We would approach it a little differently too. But yeah, I think ultimately what we were trying to get to was some, you know, emotional truth about what he was going through. And hopefully we were able to get there. And hopefully, you know, that still rings true in some way. And hopefully, you know, still, you know, can resonate with audiences and, you know, beyond.
Yeah, because really at the end of the day, it's about fear of change and insecurity, right? It's about not liking yourself. And then what are you going to do about it? And yeah. I think that major thematic, and Jorge was so great in it, you know,
he's so good in it.
And when he just moments of like when he eats the fish crackers and he knows he shouldn't, like there's just, he brought a real lot of emotion and heart to the role.
No, absolutely. And we interviewed Jorge for the podcast, and like to me, Hurley exists at such a, especially, you know, starting in 2004, such a different approach to a character like that, who is not treated as a punchline, who is treated with dignity and respect. And there's something about the way that Jorge really tackles this episode that, despite some of our like changing attitudes, it really lands emotionally nonetheless, you know?
Yeah, no, that's why, you know, it's always frightening to go back.
Well, and then, okay, so what, this episode ends with this big, oh, what the heck? Libby's in Santa Rosa.
I forgot that was in there till I watched it. I just had forgotten that blows, because it's been so long that it's been 15 years. So my memories of it are like Evan Handler and the slipper and the running and the, so I had completely forgotten. But what we loved was I think the idea of like, you know, you're setting up it's a perfect lost ending, right? It's the person that's there on the thing that just told Hurley that everything was real and not to worry about is also in the insane asylum. So now there's a character mystery. Why are they there? And, you know, what's their lost cross?
Thank you for going on that journey for us. I really appreciate it.
Oh no, it was fun. I mean, it was a really meaningful time for us. I mean, it was a special time working on that show, and then writing those episodes. That one in particular was a fun one and a special one.
Yeah, Dave was a tough one to get through.
What made it so tough?
I just remember the network being really frightened about the idea that Hurley had an imaginary friend. There was an executive who literally did not want there to be sci-fi in the show, even though the show just won an Emmy. I'm not even kidding.
Right.
And yeah. So like Hurley freaked them out, and we just kind of said, this is what the show is. We really believe in it. Dave McCarlton went to the mat and they let us do it. And then from then on, it was like, you know, cause they were always frightened by those things, because they, you know, at first they weren't like, is it a sci-fi? Is it a survival show? How do we put a box in it? Cause there wasn't anything like Lost at the time. So all their usual like things freaked them out. So when you had a scene where Walt turns the lock, it says, don't open it. They go, how does he know?
Well, it's so funny because Evan Handler is so good this role, right, as Dave. And
we wrote that for him. He was in the room. We were like, it's Evan Handler, because we had just seen him on Sex and the City, and he just seemed so mischievous. And we were like, that's the guy you picture running through the jungle in a bathrobe.
I love that. It gave me, you know, this happens a lot in early Lost where I get these like flashes of like Twin Peaks vibes. Was that at all something you were going for with him in this episode?
I don't know if we were going for it consciously. I mean, we'd certainly watched Twin Peaks.
Absolutely one of Damon's favorite shows ever.
Yeah.
So it's in the DNA of every writer in that room.
What is it like for you on the path of your career to have come from this show where you have an executive who says, no sci-fi, no genre, I don't want it, to now the current state of television where everyone is looking for something with a genre hook?
Well, I'll tell you, it's even crazier because in 2002, Adam and I were story editors on Felicity, known for its genre. So we had this idea for Once Upon a Time, and we went and our agent set us up, and we pitched it to 8 places, and they said, "You want to do a pilot that is an ensemble cast with a kid, a wolf, and dwarves and fairies? No, thank you." When Lost ended, we had an overall at ABC, and it was time to do our show. We sat down with the executives, and they were like, "Do you have anything really crazy and ensemble-y like Lost?" And we pitched Once back again 12 years later, and they're like, "Let's do it." That's how much the market changed just because of Lost.
And so when you approach something like Amazing Stories, you know, which has its DNA in, you know, in the 80s and in Steven Spielberg, you know, what is the genre friendly market like now? Even after, you know, 7 seasons of Once, you know?
What's happened right now is there's 500 TV shows and it's hard for anyone to focus. So when one show breaks through, it tends to be a big deal, but it's almost like TV is sport now, you know? It's like what show gets, it's very different, and genre is just kind of like, you know, there's so many different genres and niche shows out there that it's hard to really, I feel like Game of Thrones did it really well, but it's very hard like to have what we had on Lost, which is everybody talking about one thing. You know, can you imagine today in the world of the internet, if we ended season 1 and didn't show you what was in the hatch? There was no Twitter then. So there was no outrage. There was no way people could yell at us and be upset because at that point they were conditioned to, well, you're going to have to come back over the summer to find out who shot JR. Today, there would literally be like, this show is canceled. They did not show us that. We are entitled to know. Nobody's watching. And we, if we find the writers, we're burning them.
Everyone is very, it's the twin, like, death of the monoculture, right? Which is something we talk about. We're all not watching one thing anymore at all. And also that whole, the rise of the fandom, sometimes and not in the most positive way, in terms of what the fandom menace, I think the Star Wars people call it, where it's just sort of like, you know, you love fandoms, but there's also this entitlement, right, with fandoms.
Well, what I've noticed is that there's apparently everybody is an expert in both writing and visual effects. That is what I've noticed on the internet. Everyone seems to be an expert on those two things. And they want you to know. Like, listen, I'm a longtime Deadhead. I love the Grateful Dead. I was like, there's one of the craziest fandoms in the world, but everything was very positive. And what I feel like is, you know, Once has this great fandom, and it's great, but sometimes you see, you know, the fans fighting on Twitter and that are really getting into it or taking their aggressions out, and it becomes like this toxic place. And it's hard to kind of reconcile all this because there's just so much noise out there.
I once wrote a silly, like, little piece for Vanity Fair about the best fictional Captain Hooks. And I think I put yours at, like, number 3, maybe? Number 2? Something like that. And it was, like, maybe the most controversial thing I've ever written in my career in terms of the fandom coming at me.
Wow.
Both people who love your hook and people who, like, for some reason didn't love your hook. I don't know why. And,
they didn't love Hook because they believed Hook was standing in the way from our two female leads getting together.
The shipping fandom.
Yeah, so you had Captain Swan, which was the name of the ship, against another, and they literally, yeah, they'll come find you. It was intense.
Yeah.
I had people call my home.
You. What?
Yeah. I literally had someone call my home and go, "Is this Eddie Kitsis?" That's what the website said. And I thought, oh, geez.
Well, thankfully, my experience with the Lost fandom has been much less intense in general, and much more positive. So on that note, if you were to tell Lost fans listening to this podcast something to get them excited to go watch Amazing Stories on Apple, what would you tell them to entice them? What is, you know, if you were to tell Lost fans something about Amazing Stories, you know, to get them to check it out, what do you think Lost fans would love about Amazing Stories?
Oh, you know, I wouldn't presume to tell anyone they're going to love anything. I hope they'll love it. You know, I think that, you know, we, you know, endeavor to tell stories with, you know, character-based emotion and surprise and, you know, that, that are grounded, but that really do, you know, have some level of spirituality and some level of something extraordinary to them. So
I would also say that in 2 weeks, Josh Holloway's on and we snuck in a son of a bitch.
Oh yeah.
So,
oh, yeah.
If nothing else, yeah, you can hear him say son of a bitch like Sawyer one more time.
Oh yeah, we did do that. Oh yeah. There's that.
Did we keep that or did we have to cut that? I don't remember.
No, we still have the
son of a bitch. Yeah.
There's a Sawyer son of a bitch that made it into Amazing Story. So,
and I think a you first. Yeah, and we snuck in a you first. We got two in. Yeah.
So we got Josh Holloway on.
So, yeah, I mean, Josh Holloway is always magnificent, and he plays a very cool, fun role. So we're excited, and it's a very Spielberg role.
Excellent. And that episode actually
airs
a week from tomorrow.
This Friday.
Okay.
Yeah, a week from this Friday.
Okay.
And
so,
this week's episode, we're very excited to say, is one of Robert Forster's last performances. So.
Yes. Yeah. So if you're listening to this, this is actually going to go up next week. So if you're listening to this, the Robert Forster episode was last Friday. The Josh Holloway episode will be this coming Friday. And, you know, tune in for the son of a bitch, if nothing else.
There you go.
We'll take it.
All right. Thanks guys so much. I really appreciate your time.
All right, we'll see you at Trisha Tanaka. So,
sounds good. All right, now is the time on the show where we get to thank the Patreon subscribers at the $10 or above level. We call this a small council because we used to be a Game of Thrones podcast. So I'm going to start with some of our newcomers. We have a lot of newcomers. Thank you guys for joining us. The quarantine's getting to you too, eh? Okay, so I would like to thank Jennifer Clark, Dean Tistammer. Oh, my friend Dean. Congratulations, Dean. Annika Kaiser, Jose Cordova, Heather Walsh, Raymond McDaniel, G. Alex, Bartice, Hannah, Will Neville, Tone Kristen Loganet, Michael Caswell, James Barta, Zim, Kat Stromberger Perez, Tatiana V, Lori Carmichael Howell, David McGilvery, Caroline of the North, Priscilla Walton, and Jenna Paul. And just to clarify, I'm congratulating my friend Dean for something else, not for joining
us. Sorry, for the Patreon.
I would like to also thank Amy, Jackie Pawlowski, David Matheson, Kegley Hicks, David Adams, David Moran, AJ Cabbage, Del Martinez, Liz Beisline, Chelsea Doyle, Mark Larson, Michelle Cahill, Ben Grieving, Christopher Vanonak, Gabriel Colorado, Melanie Shu, Dane Mayer, B. Max, Kate Thrams, and LM.
And I would like to thank the following humans: Dean, Laura Anderson, Jeff Ruberg, Laura Atu, Benjamin Jacoby, Reginator Cakes, Gustavo Villarreal, DJ Empirical, Phil Jackie, aka Meme Lord, Jessica Lair, Svarir Sigfason, Manu Mishra, Megan McLeod, David Koplos, Eve Fontelay, Lily Lim, Derek Doc, Vince Louis, Russell Griffin, and Philip Durrett. Thank you all very much.
Um, So, you know, we're right in the midst of the arrival of Michael Emerson onto Lost in our rewatch right now, which is obviously a huge turning point for Lost. But I know that initially Henry Gale was just intended to be like a 6-episode character. Do you remember the moment that you all decided this guy needed to stick around?
Yeah. Wasn't it that milk scene? Wasn't watching the dailies on the milk scene?
I think it might have been the milk scene, but it was certainly watching those early dailies. We loved Michael Emerson, all of us, so much, and, you know, just as an actor, but then seeing when he came to set and brought the character to life, like, I think everybody knew, oh my God, this guy he's here for as long as we can possibly have.
We would watch the dailies during lunch. You couldn't take your eyes off him. And I just remember watching that scene where he's eating, where he asks for more milk, and everyone was like, oh my God, right. Like even not cut, just to take two, take three. It was like, we were just mesmerized.
And how does that then feed into the writer's room in terms of, okay, we want to keep this guy. How do we figure out how to fold him into the larger story?
We had a plan. We kind of attacked it twofold, in the sense that there was the A-list plan, which is, wouldn't it be great if he was the leader of the others, right? Very Lost twist. And so that was a plan. And if he didn't work, then we would have figured out, you know, like who that person was. But we were fortunate enough to be like, he's the guy.
So meaning like, I, it's been 15 years since we broke that story, so I can't remember the exact details of it, but it'd be a version of sort of like, there's a Ben Linus, it's either going to be him, or it's going to lead us to the Ben Linus.
Right.
Like, so the plan was the same, it's just how we got there would have been slightly different. So, but because he was Michael Emerson and brilliant actor, it worked out to be able to be executed the way we ultimately executed it.
This is, you know, we're also in the section of the show where we're really, really starting to lean in on the mythology aspect. I was just rewatching an interview that Damon gave where he talked about how you guys sort of really put that together between season 1 and season 2, a lot of the mythology ideas.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like to, did it ever feel, we ever feel risky to get really into mythology, or was the response of the fandom so overwhelmingly positive that you were like, we can do anything, we got this?
But here's the thing, it was a very different time, like meaning that when you say response of the fandom, like now you get response of the fandom like basically in real time,
right?
Like with, you know, Twitter and social media, like basically you can, in a writer's room, if you want it, be like, have voice.
I don't even remember, like, until there was like the fuselage in TV without pity, I didn't even know about comment boards because there was no Twitter.
Yeah.
So imagine my surprise as I went there to be lauded only to be shit on.
Oh no.
I thought people liked this.
Oh, no, but to answer your question, so it was like between season 1 and 2, I remember when we were discussing the mythology stuff, I had like sort of 2 competing emotions, you know.
That was the hatch. That was, right. Yeah, we had to go into the hatch, right.
Right. And I had 2 competing emotions, which was excitement and terror, like, which was like, you know, as Damon would pitch stuff out and like, and some of these ideas, and we would flush them out in the room, I'd be like, wow, this is really cool, and I'm excited to do this. And I would be terrified, like, what's an audience going to think? Like, how are they going to, like...
Yeah, but it was, you know, it also was interesting because, like, we became like this little group, and it sometimes, like, when it was during minicamp like that, you would forget that there was this big Lost thing out there, and it was just like the 6 of us or 7 of us sitting around a table saying, wouldn't it be cool if? And once you start getting into, like, I loved getting into the Dharma Initiative stuff, like all that late 60s, early 70s mm-hmm. stuff, and like, it was so much fun because then you're like, oh, and what if they had a hatch and the food, but it was all Dharma, and where did they come from? University of Ann Arbor was a commune, you know? It was like, and you just start spitting. And what was fun is during those mini camps is it's like you really just get to say the craziest thing without ever having any fear, and then it just slowly starts to form.
But this is what I was getting to, Eddie, which was like the terror part of it for me, though, was like what the thing that like that Damon and Carlton did was like they kind of relieved us of that. And I think this is what you were saying, Eddie, which is like it got us to the point of it's like, don't be afraid of it. It's like if you are afraid of it, that's a good thing. Like let's like face like the fear of these ideas, embrace it, and be excited by it. And that's what that room became, which is like it became about no fear. It became about all of us getting excited about these ideas and really kind of just really getting lost, like no pun intended, mm-hmm. in like that in that creative process.
It was also like how does the mythology become entertaining and not a Betamax manual? Like and you don't also, want to feel like you're reading just like a medical book.
but most critically, how does the mythology become about character? Which was like when we were discussing all this stuff about the numbers.
So like last night's a perfect example of that, because we realized we needed to test Locke's faith. As a character, he loved being on the island and we wanted to, you know, test his faith. And that's what the button was. And if you see the scene in Dave, that's why Ben Linus and Michael Emerson was such a great villain. He literally knew what Locke's weakness was, mm-hmm. that everything he was doing was for nothing.
Yeah.
And so he just served it up to him.
Right. He gives him that great speech. I don't mean that as a self-laudatory thing, but I mean as a villain, great speech of saying, here's what happened. And it shook, and I, you know, and it was really terrifying and all this, and I didn't push it. And he's, as Eddie's saying, testing Locke, pushing his weakness. And then you see Locke's reaction being, I don't believe you. And it's exactly going right at Locke's, you know, weakness or his strength, which is his faith.
I love that. It's so strong.
Also, you know, as weirdly as it really reminded me of my favorite Watchmen episode of The Looking Glass. Because my favorite moment was at the very, spoiler for anyone, and if you haven't seen it, like, come on, the Lost podcast, is at the end when the looking glass goes to the trash can and he knows that that piece of equipment doesn't work, but yet he still can't throw it out. I was like, that literally, I love that. That was like a lot of what the button was. And I think that was a lot of like all of us, which is it's like, you know, we used to say in the writer's room, if someone came in and said, if everybody doesn't run around the building two times, you're all going to die, every writer would get up and run.
And then, you know, Cynthia is really quickly thereafter not on the show anymore. Do you remember when that choice was made? And you know,
I cannot remember. I took a Facebook test the other day. It said I'm lost, and I got three wrong. I can't remember when she died. Did she die season two or three?
Season two, just like a couple episodes from now.
Oh, boy.
Was she in the double murder at the end of Lucia?
Yeah.
Yeah, but then we explain it like years later, right? Her husband died and then she goes into, like, don't we bring her back and she does it? Or was it that episode?
She talks about, we see at the end of this season that she like gave Desmond her husband's boat. It's called the Elizabeth.
Right.
All that stuff happens.
Right.
But I don't think we ever find out exactly why she was in the asylum. Perhaps trauma from her husband's
boat. That is what we were always, we were going on the trauma from her husband sent her in there to figure things out. That's, and I thought we said that, but maybe that was just something that got cut. I don't remember.
That's my hazy memory.
Are you sure that wasn't in it? Doesn't she say that to Desmond?
I'll rewatch it.
By the way, she may not. You know, you have to understand, like A, I can't remember, and B, I also remember drafts and not, like, wait. I can't remember what aired and what was cut and what was written.
And he's remembering blue pages right now.
Yeah, literally.
But that is, like, the really funny thing for us is, like our experience and memory of the show really is discussing it in the room and writing it, and it's like, and then watching it like with each other. It's like, it's a weird thing, which was like, it was actually very strange watching it with so much distance again
just now. It was like a time portal back to a part of our life from a really long time ago. It was unusual.
And we're back for the storm, or we're Ben for the storm. We can still get to say that. Still happening. Still
Ben,
can't say
Ben. Ben.
Ben. Ben. Ben. Ben. Ben. Ben. I beeped out saying Jack's father met Anna Lucia in the main pod, and we are all caught up in topics. So before we do this, I want to quickly, I googled Is Dave a Man in Black? And the answer is the show is split on that. Damon Lindelof says no. Some other people who contributed to the Lost Encyclopedia say yes, and the Man in Black doesn't need a body because Dave was never real, so he could just read Hurley's thoughts and make that happen. So I want to ask you guys, going forward for the Storm Lost Rewatch podcast, was Dave the Man in Black?
No.
I don't think so either. This is one of the ones that feels like it's completely inside the mind of a character. Because, like, other people see Kate's horse, right?
Yes.
Sawyer does.
Sawyer sees Kate's horse. Yeah. No one else sees Dave on the island. So I think this was one of the questions I had, which is like, how much of this is the island doing this? And I think it's possible that the island is like affecting Hurley in a way that manifests Dave, but the manifestation of Dave is all in Hurley's mind. I think
it's like the issue for me, and we've gone through this before, is like Kate's horse and Yemi
horse
and Yemi are like these weird Man in Black exceptions. And like, I get it, cause there's no like horse corpse, say that five times fast, on the island, right?
That's my metal band.
But like Yemi's body is on the island. So why is Yemi not the Man in Black? I don't understand that at all. But apparently that's like a whole thing, that Yemi is not the Man in Black. Anyway, if Yemi ate the Man in Black, then Dave certainly ate the Man in Black, is what I have to say.
Was Tall Soggy Walt the Man in Black?
No,
I think that's actually Tall Soggy Walt.
That's Walt projecting.
That's tall,
Electro Walt.
Normally dry Walt. Projecting himself.
It's
as
Walt soggy. In between computer time.
You know, every time you say soggy, I'm just like, dang, it's the Soggy Bottom Boys.
It's Tall Soggy Walt.
The Soggy Bottom Boys. All right, yeah.
But sorry, my brain's scrambling for a moist Anna Lucia joke and it never got there. So I just, all right.
Anyway, Dave is in Hurley's head. I think it's safe to say.
I'm okay with that. I was willing to accept that it was also the Man in Black because of how intense this push is. But I'm also okay with it, you know, just being in Hurley's head. The episode works structurally. I like it. What's this helicopter thing in season four that's at the top of our bullet points here?
Okay, so there's this moment in season four when they're trying to get to the freighter, right?
Uh-huh.
And it's like, it's Sawyer, Hurley, Kate, Jack on the freighter, and Lapidus flying. I think that's it. And they're like running out of fuel, and they have to land. Oh, and Sun.
Is this where Sawyer jumps off? Okay.
Yeah, Sawyer jumps
now
off.
Now I'm remembering it.
But like, here's what happened is Lapidus is like, oh my God, we're running out of fuel. We're gonna have to go back to the island. It's like, no, head for the freighter, you motherfucker. We're not going back to the island. And he's like, okay, we got to start dropping things that weigh stuff in the helicopter. And Hurley doesn't have any lines in this scene. He just has this like look on his face. And he remains silent. And eventually, yeah, Sawyer jumps out so that, so that they can go. And so that moment I actually think is really well done and really powerful. Like the discomfort that, Jorge Garcia has on his face without saying anything of just sort of like, oh fuck.
It's happening again. This is the deck all over again.
Yeah. This is the deck all over again. I hate the deck thing. I really hate it. But like the payoff that is that helicopter moment is very strong. So I at least wanted to give that moment its acknowledgement that I do think that moment is really strong. It's a strong nonverbal version of this, episode, which has its ups and its downs, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's all. Also another good example of Jorge Garcia being a good nonverbal actor. Like when he's not talking is good, I guess.
Plus, these guys wrote Trisha Tanaka is Dead, which is like a top five Lost episode.
Yeah, no, it's interesting that we ended up getting to talk to them for this one, because there's a lot of really good episodes actually in the Edward. We'll have to have them back to talk about one of their better ones.
That's what they said at the end of the interview. They were like, we'll see you again for Trisha Tanaka's Dead. So, you know, like.
Excellent.
Nice.
So I like the strategy of bringing people on for a Lost episode they're not, you know, like super happy with, and they have a great time talking to us. And they're like, yeah, I'll come back for the episode I am proud of.
Matthew Fox, do you want to talk to us about the Jack Setzer episode?
I don't know that they weren't like, you know, I think, you know, I don't want to put those words in their mouth. I'm not saying they're not proud of Dave. I think they just acknowledge that they would do it a little differently if they were to do it.
Yeah. I mean, well, and this is also like right before they tipped into like straight up producers. So they're still just writers. Right. They're getting like handed a bunch of like crap to make into an episode, and they're, you know, making the sausage. It's, I don't know. Fine sausage. Weird comparison to make for this episode, Dave. But again, like Moist Anna Lucia, sometimes it just happens. All right, I'm going to read you guys a Lostopedia fact. You tell me if this is a real fact or if this is fandom getting a little too into it. Here we go. When Hurley is playing Connect Four with Leonard Sims, who is saying the numbers over and over again, Leonard always says the number 8 very loud and stern. This is Hurley's candidate number.
That's a really fun
Easter eggy thing.
I just saw that written in the notes just now. I would have to go back and rewatch the scene to see if I really think that Leonard is punching those eights. So I haven't done that yet.
Well, he's got a cadence to it, because when Leonard says it, it's like 4, 8, 15, 16, 23, 42.
Okay. That sounds right. I just haven't re-listened to myself. I think the further question is, do we think they knew who the candidates were at this point?
Probably not, but they do know. If there's one character you could link to the numbers, it's going to be Hurley. So it's not out of the question that they are thinking about the numbers as people, I guess, would be the
yeah, probably the not. Point. Although this does feel like one of those things that would have been easy to retcon. So like the actor who plays Leonard may have come up with that way to say it. And then, you know, as they're writing future stuff about candidates, and somebody may have noted.
Yeah, like, which one should Hurley be? And they're like, oh, well, if you remember Dave and old Leonard Sims down there.
Remember how hard Leonard said 8? You know, something like that. Like, I don't know if I would ever believe that they had the candidate stuff figured out this far in advance.
I don't know.
Maybe the concept of candidates.
Well,
yeah, the concept of like
the whole "you can't kill me, I'm a good person" means that it's at least on their mind.
True. They also
the trial thing.
They did the thing in the other 48 days where there's like a list. There was like a list of people, or was it earlier with the beach crew? I can't remember now. But there
was one of the 48 days. Goodwin says it's a list of good people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So they there was like that concept sort of floated around that like certain people on the island were like special in a way that only the island knows so far, you know? So I guess that eventually could have become candidates.
I mean, so I'm trying to think if there's anyone. So the final six candidates are, Locke, Hurley, Sawyer, Saeed, Jack, and then it just says Quan. So you don't know if it's son or Jack, right? And so I'm trying to think of anyone who exists on the show who like would be on that list. So I don't think they don't know who the final candidates are, because their reasoning for striking Kate off the list, which is like, you're a mom. I hate that. it's not as bad as it might be. It's just like, it's not great. So like Kate should be on the list, but she's not, right? And then I think that, you know, they had these plans for Mr. Echo, in a way that like makes me think that Mr. Echo could have been a final candidate at some point. So you're right. I don't think they had it all sketched out that way, but it's fun.
It is fun.
it's fun.
It's one of those fun, like, yeah. There are, and it could even be like a happy accident sort of thing, you know, where there are a lot of fun sort of interconnectivities that maybe didn't mean anything to the writers at the time, but they become meaningful as we interpret the show later.
Yeah, there's like six numbers. There's like six people that have involved with been like governing the hatch, right, at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You have Jack, Locke, Hurley, Saeed.
What was Hurley's seat number, I wonder? Because all the numbers are in the seat numbers, right, eventually?
Oh, wow.
Because Jack's in 42F.
I mean, I know they're in Jack's.
I mean, he could have been far enough up to be eight, right? Because he's first class, so it's not
Flight
out of the question.
15 seat numbers. Let's see.
I don't think Hurley's in first
class. No, he's not.
Hurley's not in first class.
No.
He's in...
That seems...
Oh, he's in 20G and 20H. Okay, so they don't all mean something.
Okay.
No, Jack, Rose, and Bernard are in row 23. Anna Lucia is in row 42.
Fun.
And that's it for the numbers.
So, question.
Yes.
About what the guy said about Libby. So, like, the guys, Adam and Eddie, either could not recall or did a very good job of dodging my questions about, like, when did they know they were gonna, like, kill off Libby? Mm-hmm. And so, like, cause it seems to me, if you put Libby at the end of this episode with a what the fuck moment, like, you're gonna do more with Libby.
Yeah, you have
right?
other plans for Libby.
Yeah.
So it seems to me, I mean, we're gonna have to do some our research on this. I know people have done like a forensic accounting of who knew what when, but like, the idea of like, when do they know what they were gonna do, to Libby, not just Anna Lucia, but to Libby as well, is a question. And as far as I can tell watching this episode, Dave, I feel like they didn't know yet that they were gonna kill her.
When
they
this,
kill her so
yeah,
quickly
well,
after
and,
this.
And this has
you know?
To be like, if they didn't know at this point, then this has to be like the last moment before they made that decision. Or like the decision had to come between writing this episode and writing two episodes from now, basically.
Right. Well, last week on the official podcast, they said they were writing the finale. And then this week, they're like, we're sorry, we're still tired. We're still writing. But that's like after these episodes, these are like the week before these episodes are going to air. So I've already shot all of that stuff. So I still think when they shot this, the end of Dave, they didn't know what they're going to do with
it. Wow.
I think that's right. So, you know, they said their plan all along was that, you know, if we see Libby again at the end of the season in this flashback with Desmond, she gives Desmond her boat that's called the Elizabeth because her husband's dead and blah, blah, blah. And the guy said that, like, it's her husband's death that put her in the hospital, like the trauma of it. If that's the case, and I should have asked the guys this, and I, like, do you think Libby recognizes Hurley from her time in the hospital?
Yes.
That's a question I've always had. Yes.
Yeah, that's
I think
a tough
well,
one.
The reason you can't like go further into that in this episode is it undoes all of Libby's genuine goodwill that she shows. Like if the question is does Libby really like Hurley? Her remembering who he actually is and knowing it actually makes that a fuzzier question for me. Because it's like, if she shows up on the beach and she recognizes Hurley and she's like, oh, hey, this guy, but doesn't mention their like shared time together in an institution, that could be being polite, you know, but they're now like getting closer and intimate. You think that it would be a good time to bring it up. So I kind of feel like it's, if she does remember Hurley, then it reads as like her trying to help him is like a guilt thing. Like, let's go jogging on the beach. Let me help you.
That wouldn't be my interpretation. My interpretation would be, you know, that people have shame around their mental health needs, even a doctor like Libby. And, you know, she wouldn't, like, the reason for her to keep that back is because she is not ready to share it yet. But I don't think that's, like, a sneaky thing.
Well, but doesn't that make her more irresponsible as a doctor who knows what she's doing to push Hurley towards some sort of, like, breakthrough?
Well, yeah, but the show doesn't understand what bad doctoring is, like, obviously. Time and again, Jack is a bad doctor, but I don't think the show wants you to think that Jack is a bad doctor.
Well, if she remembers, then she's a bad doctor.
Yeah, I mean, I think the scenario, I think the show, by putting this scene here, and specifically putting it at the end of Hurley's flashback, I think the show really wanted that to be a question, like, in the minds of the audience. Like, I feel like that's one of the things that they would have tried to play with later, which is like, does she remember Hurley, and what are the, you know, what are the implications if she does or if she doesn't? Cause I think it really could have gone either way. Like, you know, they're, I don't know. Like, I don't, I think you could have written it out either way, but I think, as we talked about, it's like that there are all these things they never got to do with Libby, especially. I feel like it's interesting because I feel like that you can almost spot the moments where they decided that Ana Lucia had to go, and it's much earlier in the season. And the Libby thing,
when
just
they abandoned the whole, right, like, let's build an army thing.
Yeah, where, yeah, they like abandon Ana Lucia as a character for the most part. And then, but with the Libby thing, it's like right up until the end, you're thinking that Libby's gonna be here for a while.
And I think Jorge Garcia mentioned that, like, he was frustrated. Like, I love that Hurley has this romance. Mm-hmm. Like, once again, this is like in 2006. You know, men who look like Jorge Garcia aren't necessarily given, like, romances on, you know, a major network show. Mm-hmm. And that he's, like, given this romance is lovely. And it's shitty that she dies. It feels like almost like a really shitty false comparison, but it reminds me of the barrier gaze trope, where it's like, oh, like, the fat dude gets a girlfriend, that, don't worry, you don't have to, like, keep watching that, we're gonna, like, cut that out, don't worry, you know what I mean? The same way that, like, you know, the barrier gaze trope is that, like, as soon as, you know, two gay people get together, like, one or both of them dies or whatever. So Hurley and Libby get together, and then she dies just a few episodes later. That sucks. Mm-hmm. And Jorge Garcia never gets a love interest again on the show after that, and that sucks. So, you know, I wish they had not killed Libby.
I mean, I think the answer to the original question is, I want her to not remember. Like, I want the answer to have been, Libby, for whatever reason, did not remember Hurley, and everything she's doing on the island is genuine.
Well, I think it can be both. Well, my headcanon is that she remembers him. She's not ready to, like, admit that she was also in Santa Rosa, but, like, maybe she liked him in the mental institution.
Yeah. You know? Maybe there's, like, another set of flashbacks where they interact in the institution, yeah, and he just doesn't remember.
Yeah.
Dave too. The, yeah, Davening.
Yeah, I think it's probably good that they didn't do a Dave too.
Yeah, Libby even shocked Stephen King in that interview we were talking about earlier. He has a quote in conversation with Jeff Jensen, J.J. Abrams, Lindelof, and Cues. He says, the story's the boss, and one of the great pleasures of Lost is how things happen that you don't expect. I was shocked when Ana Lucia got shot, and then Michael turned around and shot Libby. That got under my gaw, and I've got a trained gaw. One of the other great pleasures is the way those numbers have been worked in over and over again in ways that seem completely inexplicable. So it got under his gaw, but old maybe Stephen because King. They didn't know they were doing it.
I would recommend that interview that Jeff Jensen did in 2006. That is, it's J.J. Abrams, Lindelof and Cuse, and Stephen King with Jeff Jensen. One of the better ones I've come across so far as just, like, conversations about Lost and writing and horror. I guess this is like they all got together and went and saw, like, The Descent and had lunch.
Oh,
and then they talked about Lost.
The Descent.
It was like, what? What a wild thing. Cool. So I would.
Jeff Jensen, what a life.
Yeah. For our, for our Storm folks, I would recommend reading that. Don't pass it along to your Calmies friends. So.
Yeah. If I got a few more weeks before they could read that. Yeah.
Literally that answer alone is a bad one.
Yeah. We have some emails, Storm emails.
Yeah. So there's one from Robbie, Which is lovely. Robbie is also like a longtime Lost fan, but like newcomer to the podcast. So this is really fun for me. Like all the like Lost, diehard Lost fans are finding us. So nice to see you here, guys. Folks, so Robbie's email gives some context, to his relationship with Lost. But then he says, you know, I love the finale. Will stand my ground against anyone who says otherwise. Lost, for all its mystery, has always been about its characters. The mysteries draw you in. What is the monster? Why is there a polar bear? Who are the others? Locke was in a wheelchair. But it's the characters that keep you coming back episode to episode. The ending was a resolution, not to all the mysteries, but to the characters. You fall in love with each of them as you watch this ragtag group of flawed individuals succeed and fail together, becoming more complex and interesting each week. It's for this reason that I don't have a lot of episodes of Lost that I dislike. You guys have voiced some frustration over the show hammering you over the head with Locke's dad, Charlie's drug addiction, Jin's abusive behavior, etc. I get that, and there's validity to that, especially when it's a full 42-minute episode that is just round three of Charlie's addicted to heroin. It does start to feel old, but Lost at its core is a show about redemption. We meet a whole bunch of flawed individuals in this show, and for many of them, their time on the island sees them become something better. Change is not easy in the real world. We can't just clean our lives up overnight. And what I love about Lost's character development is it isn't just a sudden change for almost anyone. Sometimes we succeed and sometimes we fail, but ultimately isn't that battle part of what makes us human? By the time everyone is united at the end, each of those characters feels like their growth and transformation was earned. I'm going to stop myself before I externally process my overarching theory of Lost via email. I'll wrap up with my top five favorite characters and would love to hear each of yours. Number one, Desmond. Number two, Ben. Number three, Sawyer. Number four, Echo/Juliet. That feels like a cheat. I guess like when one exits, the other enters or whatever. Number five, Lapidus. Wishing you guys the best in this difficult time. Stay safe out there, Robbie. So Robbie, thank you for your email. And I think that theme of redemption is something that, you know, maybe the show is going for in this episode. I just don't see like Hurley's physical state as a flaw that needs redeeming in the way that like addiction heroin, maybe some of what Neil was talking about in terms of like an unhealthy relationship to food that makes you feel bad about yourself, mm-hmm. that makes you feel shame, that makes you feel all that. That's something to work on, just the way, you know, heroin addiction is for sure. I think the show could have just done it better. I think the best example of this maybe is that Jin arc that we were talking about in a recent episode where it's like, bad Jin comes back very briefly and then he's like, sorry, mm-hmm. my bad, I'm working on it. Let me fix your garden. Sorry, I did that. Anyway, do you guys feel comfortable? Dave, I know you haven't like rewatched the show in a while, but do you feel comfortable doing your top five favorite lost characters right now?
Oh yeah, but mine are gonna be ridiculous.
Hit me.
All right. In number five, we have Joanna, rest in peace, you tried to go swimming. In number four, we have both Scott and Steve, because, you know, if you're going to hyphen right. one, why not? Number three, we have Dr. Peter Chang, because he had mystery. Number two, we have Electro Waltz, who's inside Chang? The computer. Pierre Chang. God, okay. Pierre Chang.
I just want to make sure we don't get like 1,000 emails.
Yeah, it's like Dave's joke list was wrong. Number two, Electro Waltz, and number one, Horse.
Horse? This one, it is tough because I'm not very much further than we are in my like deep rewatch. So I'm like only in season three, but like there's part of me that wants to put like Daniel Faraday on the list. I was always a big yes. Charlotte fan. I don't know why yet, but we're going to revisit that.
We found the Charlotte fan.
Wait. You're the only one.
I think I'm the only Charlotte fan ever. Juliet is on the list. I think Sawyer is on my mm-hmm. list. I love Sawyer's whole arc, you know, for the show. Yeah. And you know what? I give it up to Hurley because Hurley really does, make it to the end. And like, you know, like, I don't know. It's like the island chooses Hurley in the end. So it's like, to me, Hurley is the most, one of the most important, if not the single most important character in Lost, because eventually he's the one who has to oversee the island, you know? So yeah, I think Hurley's my number one.
So, okay. I just realized someone important was missing from my list. So I had
See, that's the tough part.
I had to drop Daniel Faraday, which hurts my heart because I love him so much. Also, in regards to the Sawyer arc, our producer Diana is almost done with her Lost rewatch. We're in the final season, and we got to the part where, like, Juliet has died, and Sawyer is, like, processing that, and he's sitting on the edge of a body of water, a bay. It's not quite the shore. Mm-hmm. I don't know. And he's talking about how he was going to marry her. And Josh Holloway does this, like, incredible job. He's, like, crying, and it's, like, really upsetting. And, like, Diana turns to me, and she's like, "You were right about Sawyer." I was like, that feels so good. It feels so good. She's like, he has the best arc on the show. I was like, he does. Anyway, so my top five, number five, John Locke, which bumped Faraday and Lapidus off the list, and that bugs me. But anyway, number five, John Locke. Number four, Juliet. Number three, Ben. Number two, Sawyer. Number one, Hurley. So... those are my faves. My faves.
Nice.
All right. And then we have one more email. This is the ongoing conversation we're having about who the leader of the others are. This is from Matthew Wilson, the others and their org chart. he writes, last week he discussed the leadership of the others and whether Richard was ever their leader. My personal impression is that Richard was not officially the leader, but was an authority figure because he was the connection to Jacob. If we believe the Lost Encyclopedia, then the others had a relatively flat management structure for most of their existence. It says, within the others, Jacob and Albert had never appointed anyone within the others as a leader. They had allowed everyone to work things out for themselves. And then Matthew writes, that seems in line with Jacob's conversation with Richard and Abiturno. And then the Lostpedia resumes, by 1954, a young woman named Eloise Hawking emerged as the others' de facto leader, as she was a fervent believer in protecting the island. And then by the 1970s, Widmore began to assume authority in many situations, even though the others still considered Eloise their sole leader. I have to say, we only get like bit flashes of like Eloise and Charles on the island, in seasons 5 and 6, I think. I would love to watch a whole show about how Eloise Hawking is like running the others and being super competent and like staunchly British. And then her fuckboy of a boyfriend, Charles Widmore, tries to take the others from her.
Yeah. That's the spinoff
right
there.
She's like, I might be pregnant with your baby, but guess what? You'll never know your son because you're an asshole and I hate you, Charles Widmore. And, I would watch that show big time. Anyway, so those are some emails we got. Thanks.
Nice.
Awesome. Yeah, we're about to, run into the big conclusion of season two. We're in the down turn to climax. No, the denouement was after the climax. We're in the climax, let's say. Because,
we're almost to the climax. I would say, Michael showing up at the end of, not next week, but the week after is sort of the climax.
All right, so that means we have to spend one more week dealing with some other stuff on the island. Neil, what's happening next week?
Well, next week we've got an episode called SOS, and it is...
For Storm of Spoilers.
A Rose and Bernard episode. The first Rose and Bernard episode. And the only... No, there's other Rose and Bernard episodes, right? No? This is the only one? All right, the only Rose and Bernard episode.
Yeah.
The Rose and Bernard episode. So until next week, where we check in on that, where can people find more of your work online since they are stuck inside? Let's start this week with Neil Miller.
You can get me over at the filmschoolrejects.com and on Twitter at Rejects. And don't forget to follow the show at Storm Podcast. There's all kinds of fun stuff happening there.
Do you want to plug Columbo?
If you're listening to this in real time, we're about to launch on One Perfect Shot a bracket to determine what is the most bingeable television show of all time. And I'm happy to report that Lost is on the bracket, but also Columbo, apparently. I'm not sure why. But we'll find out more as we roll that out this coming week.
So as you guys are watching on Twitter, I'm not going to say it's going to mean a lot to Neil, but it would mean a lot to me if Lost were to win this bracket at One Perfect Shot. So, yeah. Vote. Vote responsibly. There's no voter fraud when it's electronic, right, Neil?
Yeah, as far as I know.
Okay, good. Joanna, where can people find more of your stuff online?
Well, you can find me at vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. If you are following the television show Westworld, I have two podcasts that I'm doing, Decoding Westworld and Still Watching for Vanity Fair, both of which are breaking down the season. So, and also on my other podcast, Little Gold Men, we are starting something we're calling Oscar Season Essentials. I forget. Katie branded it. I don't know.
It looks fun. I voted in the poll.
Oh, did you? What did you vote for?
Shit, what were the options again?
Okay. Something essentials. Basically, we're picking movies four movies every week, either best picture winners or like things that had Oscar buzz or something like that, that are streaming online that you all can watch, and we're gonna watch them this week, and then you can vote on which one we watch, then we watch, we'll talk about it. So this week, our candidates are, by the way, I hope you're enjoying how in the comic I keep saying the word candidate as often as I can. It's a fun thing that I do for myself. Okay. Sunset Boulevard, From Here to Eternity, Midnight Cowboy, and The Gangs of New York.
Oh, I voted for Gangs of New York.
I have never seen. Fun fact about me, I've never seen, From Here to Eternity. I don't know why, because it seems very much my jam. Or, Midnight Cowboy. Wow. That's fun. But Sunset Boulevard is winning by a
lot. Yeah, good. That's what I would vote for. Okay, good.
I think that's what we're gonna watch.
Good job. Good job, Twitter poll. That makes me feel better about winning Neil's poll, too. All right. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can find the show on Twitter at Storm Podcast. You can also find me on the Fighting in the War Room podcast, where we're in pandemic week 3. We just get together, and we're four people whose industries have been upended, talking about what we do every day. It's been interesting. But also, it's important that you come here to continue watching Lost with us, have some normalcy, and do not fall down.